The matter of Turner versus Commonwealth. Good morning once again. Mr. Hayden, would you care to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, 5 minutes.
Yes, sir, and you may begin whenever you're ready.
Thank you. Mr. J. Ron Russell Turner was convicted in the Newport News Circuit Court of one count of robbery, one count of carjacking, two counts of use of a firearm in the commission of a felony, received an active sentence of 8 years. We have assigned as error that the trial court erred in letting Officer Umbell repeat hearsay information derived from another officer, where the absent officer's information was not admissible under any exception to the hearsay rule.
Well, tell us the difference between what the alleged hearsay was and what the officer actually testified to that he saw.
Well, the officer, Umbell, could not testify where Mr. Turner was apprehended. He gets it purely through hearsay information that he's apprehended in the 3300 block of Utah Place, about two blocks from where Epps' car had been stopped in Richmond. So that's pure hearsay there. It's a probative fact that he's found in the vicinity of where the car had been stopped, and it's coming through at page 33. He admits that of the appendix, he admits that this comes purely from another officer's information. He wasn't there when the guy was detained. He didn't know where the guy had been apprehended. He also learns from the officer that the guy was coming, that Turner was coming out of the backyard, and that he was dirty and out of breath.
You didn't answer my question. It seems to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, the difference between the officer's testimony who actually saw the appellant and the officer who related the story. The officer who saw him said that he had dirt on his shirt, he was wearing black, he was out of breath. And that was the same testimony that you say is hearsay, other than the defendant came out of the backyard. Is that correct?
I respectfully disagree with that contention. On page 33 of the appendix, at the very bottom, line 24, we have the testimony of Officer Umbell, where he says there were officers near the vicinity of the traffic stop before we initiated it. All right, now he's getting this information, not what he personally observed. And he says, then Mr. Turner was detained two blocks from the initial site of where the traffic stop was in the same block number. He says Mr. Turner was located in the 3300 block of Utah Place. Objection, that's hearsay. You're telling us where he was detained, and Officer Umbell doesn't know this of his personal knowledge. He admits that he wasn't present. He doesn't know where he was detained. He doesn't know that it was close by the car, or within two blocks, or that it was at the 3300 block of Utah Place.
I'm not asking you for argument. I'm just saying, what is the difference between the hearsay and what the officer actually observed?
Well, that's the difference. The officer did not actually observe that he was detained in the 3300 block of Utah Place. The officer did not observe that the defendant was coming out of a backyard and that he was dirt covered and had and was panting out of breath. And he says, so you're relying on what someone else told you, that he was out of breath? Yes, someone else told me that's the reason I stopped him, why he was a suspect, why it is there is a reason to think that he had some connection with that car. There's absolutely no evidence in the record from of Officer Umbell's personal knowledge that the defendant had anything to do with that car, that he was detained in the vicinity of the car or was coming out of the backyard, had been, for all the officer knew of his personal knowledge, he might have been picked up on the other side of Richmond. He had no personal knowledge of that. But he says, based on what the officer tells me about where he's picked up, I know that that's within two blocks. But he's asked, is this something that you personally saw? Did you see Mr. Turner that night? No, I did not. So everything you're relying on is what some other officer told you, he says on page 38. Yes, sir. And so pure hearsay.
The Commonwealth maintained that it was offering it not for the truth of the matter asserted, but just to explain Umbell's actions subsequent to appellant's detention. Is that correct?
That's what they asserted.
And the trial court allowed it on that basis.
But that's what the judge ruled.
And this is a bench trial, so he didn't have to worry about a jury that might not accept it for the proper purpose.
Right. That's correct. But for what purpose is this evidence being offered that it's in the 3,300 block of Utah Place, that he's caught coming out of the backyard, panting and out of breath, and that it's that's the reason he's stopped as a suspect? Officer Umbell can't testify of his personal knowledge why Turner is a suspect at all. He doesn't know. All he knows is he does a search of Turner later. He testified to that. The Commonwealth Attorney maintained, well, it's not offered for the truth of the matter asserted. What is it being offered for? The Officer Umbell can testify to his personal knowledge. I do a search. I find the two credit cards. He can testify to that of his personal knowledge. I might support a conviction for possession of stolen property, but it doesn't show any connection with the car that Turner was one of the four people observed running from the car. Because the officer has no basis for knowing of his personal knowledge where Turner had been detained or where he was first apprehended. The Commonwealth, in their brief on page 16, they seek to explain, well, what is the purpose of this if it's not offered for the truth of the matter asserted? They say, well, it shows why Turner was arrested. In other words, why he's a suspect, why there's probative evidence suggesting he's guilty of this crime and has a connection to the car. And precisely what's prohibited is showing probative evidence that's not based on the personal knowledge of Officer Umbell. And they are going to say it shows why Turner was arrested and why Officer Umbell searched Turner.
How he came into contact with him to begin with, I think.
Right, but they're establishing he's a suspect because he's close by. He's apprehended in the 3,300 block of Utah Place, just two blocks from where this other car had been stopped. But Officer Umbell doesn't know that of his personal knowledge. He's relying purely on hearsay for that. So at that point, it is clearly hearsay. It's asserting matters. And it is for the truth of the matter asserted to show why we think he's a suspect, why we think he's connected to that car of Epps that was found in Richmond, because it was close by. And he was seen coming out of the backyard as if fleeing and was out of panting and out of breath. And those are indicia of guilt. And
I guess the difficulty I have is in a bench trial where the court has asserted that it is not accepting it for the truth of the matter asserted. What evidence is there in the record to suggest otherwise?
Because that was the only evidence, that hearsay evidence, that linked Mr. Turner to the car. There is zero evidence.
Credit card.
He has the credit card.
The car was in the name of the victim, and Mr. Turner is found with credit cards in the name of the victim on his person. That's a pretty big link, isn't it?
It doesn't establish that he was running, one of the persons running from the car.
It kind of does establish that, at least circumstantially, by the time they conduct a search on him.
I would note that Epps had a wallet stolen. He didn't find the wallet. He had an iPhone 5 that was stolen.
Well, that becomes
wasn't
an
found
issue.
With that
that becomes an issue for the fact finder, not for the appellate court.
He wasn't found with the keys to the car that was stolen. The defendant makes no incriminating statements to say I had been in the car. They don't have any
fingerprints. The car was still running, so he couldn't have had the keys to it.
Right. I suppose that's correct, but certainly there was no indicia they didn't link him to the car by means of fingerprint or DNA evidence.
No, but he was identified by the victim.
19 months after the trial, he says, "This at trial, he says, Mr. Turner is the guy I saw." Yet that this was a person that the victim Epps had never seen before. He hasn't had an encounter for 10 minutes with this person. He says within 5 feet of this person for about 10 minutes. And the very day after the robbery is taking place, he's shown a photo spread that contains Epps, that contains Turner's photo. Doesn't identify Turner, but does identify another person as being the person who robbed me.
Doesn't he give an explanation for the misidentification?
He says, well, the photo that was used in the photo spread was apparently taken a long time before by the police, and it didn't show this droopy eye that he expected to find. Of course, I'm kind of wondering, what is it? That certainly suggests that photo spread's tainted in itself, that the police is telling him, hey, be alert, that we're taking a photo of our suspect from a long time ago, and so he might not look well, the way he looks now.
Well, he picked somebody out in the photo array that did have an eye problem, is that right?
He said that, but I look at the photo that's contained in the as an attachment to the Commonwealth's brief. Their page number, they numbered it as page 11. I look at that photo, I don't see anything abnormal about that person. So his explanation doesn't make sense to me, that he says, well, the person I did identify had a drooping eye.
I guess the point is it made sense to the fact finder.
And I would note beyond that, when he's testifying at trial, he's talking about how Turner was the shorter of the two persons that he identified. There was a tall guy who did all the talking. Turner was the short guy. He testifies to very positively during the course of the trial. Yet if we look at the actual photo spread identification, that where he identifies this as being the person who robbed him, he says, "This looks like the suspect that robbed me of my possessions." And he says he looks like the taller of the two suspects. And he's saying that this is the person with the droopy eye that wasn't doing most of the talking, he'd said at trial was the shorter of the persons. So it's a clearly unreliable thing to say that 19 months after the trial, when he gets to trial and he says, he's asked, "How do you know now that this is the person?" Because I can tell by his smirking face as he's looking at me. And I never forget a face. Of course, he forgot the person's face the very day after the robbery.
That argument's for the fact finder, isn't it, Mr. Hayden?
I was addressing the issue of, didn't the victim identify the defendant at trial as the same? But 19 months after the robbery, he claims at trial, "This is the guy, and I know because of his smirking face, and I never forget a face." But the evidence of unable to identify the very morning after, that belies the positiveness.
Mr. Hayden, let's go back to the hearsay, because I want to be sure I understand your argument. Officer Umbell testified the appellant was wearing a black jacket, T-shirt, covered with dirt, and seemed out of breath. You're saying that was simply based on the hearsay given to Officer Umbell?
The Officer Umbell observed of his personal knowledge that he had on a black jacket. He observes of his own personal knowledge that he was still breathing heavily. He doesn't say you ever saw him coming out of the backyard.
No, I understand. And we talked about that some time ago, and I said that was the only difference, wasn't it?
Right.
Umbell never knew where he came from,
right,
or where he was located, but was able to describe his physical condition, which was the same as the hearsay, right?
He's able to describe that he's out of breath. And he's able to say that
that he was wearing a black jacket and a T-shirt and covered with dirt.
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
And I would note that he says that that the defendant had a Taurus 9mm. It's interesting that the victim testifies that the person he says was the defendant had a Glock 9mm.
He said Glock style, didn't he?
Glock style. And certainly, but Glock has a very specific appearance. And so this, it's certainly, at best, the inference...
Did counsel ask any questions on cross-examination about what he meant by Glock style or... address anything specific about a descriptive term on that?
No. It's just simply...
to me, it seems pretty impressive that he could pick out that it was a 9mm as opposed to a 40 caliber or anything of that nature.
Right. It's a common type of gun. And certainly, the what we have here is, although this is reviewed on an abuse of discretion standard, admissibility of evidence, where the trial court has no discretion... The trial court has no discretion to admit clearly inadmissible evidence because admissibility of evidence depends upon not upon discretion of the court, but upon sound legal principles. And by definition, it's an abuse of discretion when the court abuses its discretion when it makes an error of law, and that's reviewed de novo. And errors of law. Determining whether it's an error of law.
And Mr. so Hayden, the burden, excuse me, the hearsay has to be offered for the truth of it, right?
Right.
And if it's not offered for the truth of it, it's not hearsay.
Right, but it was offered. Right.
So when the trial judge said, I'm not accepting it for the truth of it or for whatever reason, why isn't that the end of that argument?
Because the court clearly is relying upon, there is a, if a person has the credit cards, he may be a recipient of, from one of those four persons that ran from the car, they hand off the two credit cards to Turner, but it doesn't show that Turner was one of the persons fleeing from the car. There's no connection to the car, and no evidence established.
If that's the only thing you've got,
and
but it's not the only thing they had.
The only thing connecting Mr. Turner to that car is the assertion of the other officer that he was apprehended within two blocks of the car,
and the identification by the victim. That connects him directly to the car.
If we throw out the whole car bit, there's testimony that he's the perpetrator. The victim identified him at trial. There was testimony that the defendant pointed the 9mm Glock-style pistol at the victim. So why do we even need the car business?
Because when the defendant or when the victim is it's a plainly a dubious identification, when a person observes a person for 10 minutes, not 30 seconds, but 10 minutes, he says, at a range of 5 feet away, within 5 feet, and then the very next day cannot identify that very same person as the person he talked to for 10 minutes the night before.
But why couldn't the trial court accept his explanation that when I encountered the defendant, he had some eye condition, pink eye or something like that, and in the photo array, I picked out the only person that had that eye condition?
And it's hard to tell that there really is any eye condition that I can see, but if there were, clearly the person...
But you weren't the fact finder, the judge was, and he clearly accepted that explanation because I don't think it's in controversy that the photo that was taken by the Newport News officer shortly after the defendant's arrest was not the one that was used in the photo array.
Right, that's correct. And so clearly we have this person who's out there saying the day after the offense, that's the person that robbed me incorrectly, and who had no prior contact with Turner. And so, this is clearly a dubious thing. And apparently he's being instructed by the police that, keep in mind that this picture was taken a long time ago before, and so appearances change. And we have, when he's actually asked on cross-examination, how do you know this is the person? He says, the reason I can identify Turner now is because he's got that stupid smirk on his face, and he's staring at me. That's how I can identify him. That's not a rational basis for saying that this is a reliable. He says, I'm looking right at him. I looked at him when he had the gun in his. I looked at him when he pointed the gun at my leg, and I'm looking at him now. And when a situation like that happens, you never forget a face. You never forget distinctive features. When, in point of fact, he did the very next day when he was presented the photo spray. It's an unreliable identification. And the only basis, the standard is where non-constitutional error occurs and the admissibility of its burden is on the Commonwealth to show that it had no effect on the trier of fact. But clearly the judge was influenced by it. He's caught two blocks from this car.
Well, the fact finder said it had no.
He said, but
he didn't consider it. So we need to. You want us to write an opinion saying that the trial judge lied?
No, sir. But I certainly would submit that
We'd be more tactful than that, but we'd have to say that we don't believe the words of the trial court.
It certainly would appear that it, although it was said, not accepted for the truth of the matter asserted, it does, in fact, have a carry weight that he's found just two blocks away and coming out of the backyard, panting and dirty, and this is why we think he's a suspect. He must have been fleeing. He's out of breath because he's running from that car. He must be connected to the car. And I submit it did have an influence on the trial judge.
Mr. Hayden, we are well over time. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Good morning, may it please the court. I'm Victoria Johnson. I'm here for the Commonwealth. This court should affirm because the trial court didn't abuse its discretion in admitting the testimony over the hearsay objection, and there's evidence in the record to support the trial court's finding that Mr. Turner was the perpetrator. Just real briefly as to the hearsay matter, we have the court saying in a bench trial that it did not consider the testimony for the truth of the matter. It's at appendix page 40. The court said that he allowed the testimony in order to give context, essentially. We have a cold record for the court statement. It's a little confusing. But essentially, the court said that it was allowing the testimony to explain how Officer Umbrell came in contact with the defendant and what happened after that. And I think that's dispositive in this case. We have the trial court's own interpretation of its ruling. If the court has questions about the hearsay issue, I'm happy to answer them. Okay. I'll move on to the sufficiency issue. Essentially, the appellant is trying to ask this court to reweigh the credibility of the victim here. And that was, as the court knows, the trier of fact's responsibility. While Mr. Epps failed to identify Mr. Turner in the initial photo spread that he was shown the day after, he explained his reasons for that. He was looking for someone with an eye condition. That's a factor that the trier of fact could consider and a factor that this court can consider, but it's certainly not dispositive of the reliability of the eyewitness identification. Instead, we look at the Neal v. Biggers factors, which I went over in my brief. Briefly, he had a good opportunity to view Mr. Turner at the time of the crime. It was a 10-minute conversation. The defendant wasn't wearing a mask. The victim said that it was in good light. The witness showed a normal degree of attention. He said that the man was pointing a gun at him, and he was looking him right in the face. And we have the most important factor of all, just to move along, we have his level of certainty at his in-court identification. And that's something that the court has emphasized in Satcher, Brown, and McCary. Those were cases, Brown and McCary, where there was not a prior identification from a photo spread, but this court affirmed the convictions because there were reasons for that. In Brown, the victim said that she didn't identify the defendant in the photo spread because she didn't want to make an identification unless she was 100% sure. In McCary, the victims couldn't identify the bank robber and were later told that by police that the defendant was the robber, but that this court still confirmed the court still affirmed the conviction in those cases as well. Here, the witness said that he was sure, you never forget a face in that kind of situation, and that he was recalling the defendant's face from the time of the robbery during trial. For those reasons, Your Honors, I submit this case should be affirmed. If the court has questions, I'm happy to answer them.
I'm done.
Thank you. We will come down and greet counsel.
Thanks.
All right.